Right, 408.
So you were saying obviously it's stronger if there's one person.
Yes, yes.
And does it become even stronger if it's in front of 10 people?
Does it become stronger in front of 10 people? The public netter of money, the public netter of money is certainly is very severe. If it's a public pledge for money, that's very, very severe. 408 is the command, again, we've done is the command for the Bnei Israel to give the Levium cities to live in. How many cities were there? 48 cities, and these cities doubled as the Levim cities of refuge, correct? Where the accidental murderers would go to the cities. I told you one of the commentaries says...
So there will be more places of refuge when Mashiach comes? There will be more places
of refuge? No. So there will be 48 places of refuge, and the commentaries say that the reason they go to the Levim is because even if the Levim being on a higher level, which we learned yesterday, they'll be willing to overlook any of the imperfections that this unintentional murderer has, like if he had killed accidentally one of their relatives. Right. Let's say the Levim, the guy comes to their city of refuge. Let's say he kills somebody unintentionally, and this guy was one of their own relatives. Right. So the Levim are expected to be on such a level, well, they'll be willing to overlook what he's done. Right. And therefore, the Torah recommends the cities of refuge. I told you the other idea is that they should be around the Levim because the Levim will exert some type of positive influence on him, as opposed to sending him to jail where he'll learn from other convicts and criminals how to become a better killer. Right, so that's the sort of thing that's going on. The same thing with the Eved Ivri, by the way. The Hebrew slave, remember we spoke about the Hebrew slave was sold? Why do you sell the Hebrew slave? Why he's sold because he's stolen, he can't make restitution. Why do you sell him? Like, why don't you put him in jail? Right, the answer is that we sell him to an owner who is a fine, upstanding, God-fearing Jew so that living in close proximity with a God-fearing Jew, he could learn himself how to become a God-fearing Jew, as opposed to going to jail and hanging around with criminals. At times of the Gomorrah and at times of the Beis Hamikdash, there were very few jails, right? The jails, there was no problem of overcrowding in Jewish jails because there were almost no jails to speak of, right? Because the only time you put people in jail was if the guy had to die, right? You couldn't execute him in court, so they put him in jail within a short time. He died, or under extenuating circumstances, you didn't know what to do with the guy. They put him in jail until they could find someone, figure out what to do with him. But there was no such thing as putting a guy in jail, providing him 3 square meals a day and color television, right? Because they don't feel like turning on the gas chambers, right? So they were in Torah law, such a thing.
But I went to prison, you know, with some chabadis, and I've actually got a shul. I've turned the prison into a shul, so the prisoners don't even feel, they don't even know that they're in prison. They forget that they're in prison because they've got a whole shul running it.
Was a prison for Chabad?
No, I'm saying they've got a Chabad person there, and they've got Hasidim coming in, or something like that, and they actually turned the shul into, they turned the prison into
all Jewish prison.
They're lacking the Hasidim in prison.
No, I'm saying I went to the prison.
I've only got to put another hour. I saw the prisoners, the murderers, that are sitting there in lockstep, and they forget that
they actually.
They're not. They forget. They're
doing Torah. So they have a program. They actually have a program in Israel. Actually, I once spoke at a prison here. They have a guy took me down to this prison. It was one of the first times I just started or some match. Went down to the prison, and what they do is they have a program. They have a Baal Tshuva program in the prison, right? So they've done statistics, and they found, you know, because if the guy becomes a Baal Tshuva in prison, so he could be released early. Right, which is a great deal, just put on black hats, so you're from, right? Mm-hmm. So they've done statistics, and they found, and they have to monitor them, obviously. They found that the people who became Baal Tshuva in prison, whereas normally they had a 70% return rate for convicts that were released. They were let out of prison, put into society, and then there was a 70% return rate, that eventually 70% of them ended up back in prison. Among the regular convicts. And among the Baal Tshuva, because people were skeptical, you know, how sincere could these Baal Tshuvas be? Among the Baal Tshuvas, they had a 6% return rate.
Six?
Six, versus a 70%. It was so successful that even the government felt that it was better to have Baal Tshuvas than convicts, right? Even from Jews, or at least they're better than convicts.
Yeah.
You know, in this country, it's not, you know. So the government, they had ones in the Jerusalem Post. I saw they had this article, 25 Ways to Improve Jerusalem. and I think number suggestion number 9 was to make Jerusalem a better place. Suggestion number 9 was all you Shiva students and convicts should sweep the streets, right? And I was absolutely shocked and dismayed because it weighted all the way down to number 9. I figured for sure it would be number 2 or 3. You know, that I was expecting to see it, right? There it was, number 8, and that was in the Jerusalem Post, right? So if they would have showed you that Nazi Germany, it would have been like outraged, right? Because they have those right here in Israel.
Yeah.
Right? So they had this program. The program was very, very successful. These things about, you know, they teach them Torah and so on. So I just remember that there I was in the prison grounds, and the guy was giving me, the guy who took me, he was pointing to me, oh, hey, armed robbery. There's an overt murder. There's an overt, he's a widower to do it yourself way. he cooked his wife. That's what he told me. Right? And I remember I was talking to this one guy, he's about 63, and he's looking down at me and talking to this guy. And they're chatting with him there on the prison grounds, and all of a sudden I'm looking around, there isn't a guard in sight. Right? And there's absolutely nothing stopping this guy from bending down and biting my head off without anybody doing anything. Right? And it was amazing with the prisoners, when you talk to the prisoners, it's nobody's at fault, nobody did anything wrong. I mean, a prison full of guys who did nothing wrong. Right? None of them are guilty. It's amazing. Not one of them is guilty. Not one of them is guilty. All of them, it's because somebody misled them or somebody. I said to the guy, why are you here? He looks and goes, I trusted the wrong people. you're a tzaddik, you know, I'm sure that you did nothing wrong, you trusted the wrong people. And there was one guy, and there's one guy with the beard. There's like all these guys, like you could feel that none of their moms about you. After I finished this talk, one guy comes over to me, and I'm looking at him the whole time. He's got like a long, bushy beard. He looks like something that's set right out of Mayashar. And as I'm talking, every time I mention a Gemara or something, I see him nodding his head like this, right? And he's practically saying the words with me. I think to myself, my goodness, what is this guy? The family effort, like, I walked on. I said, well, you know, why are you here? He looks like, oh, I forgot to pay my taxes. You forgot to pay your taxes. Okay, look, maybe he did forget to pay his taxes, right? But that's, you know, that was hard crime. But that was the only, what's interesting, and you can tell this to your friends, is that in a prison for hardened criminals, the only from ultra-Orthodox Jew there was there for a white-collar crime, right? So you can tell your friends that there are certain advantages to what the society is producing. 409 is the prohibition to kill a sinner when we see him sinning before bringing him to Beis Din. That means if you see somebody who's about to do an avera, which is punishable by capital punishment. For instance, he's about to go worship idols. You have an obligation to warn him. You and if there isn't somebody else with you, you have to do it yourself. But if there's somebody else with him, the two witnesses have to warn him that what he's about to do is punishable by death in court. Now, the mitzvah 409 is the prohibition to kill someone in order to stop him from doing an avera. I mean, if somebody is going to bow down to an idol, or, in a more extreme sense, somebody is going to commit an act of bestiality, right, which is also prohibited by Torah law, or even, in certain sense, somebody who is going to commit adultery, which is prohibited by Torah law, it is forbidden for you to take the law into your own hands and to kill him. The only time that you're allowed to kill somebody in order to stop him from doing an avera is when? If he's going to kill somebody else, or if he's going to rape a married woman, or if he's going to rape a male. Those are the only times. I'm sorry, not an unmarried woman. That is correct. Because even if he were to rape, let's say the unmarried woman, one second, guys. Don't think that this is the Torah society was just a raping society, because after all, the Torah says you can't kill somebody to stop. You definitely have to stop it. You have to stop somebody from raping even an unmarried young lady, right? You can't kill him. Right? You can break his kneecaps, but you can't kill him, right? So the Torah says that if a man, the difference is as follows. What if a married woman would consent to the relationship, right? Then it's an act of adultery. They both deserve to be killed, right? The only difference here is she's not consenting, but the act is an act of capital punishment. What's the punishment for rape in the Torah of a non-married woman? The punishment for rape is just that he has to marry her. He has to pay a fine and then he has to marry her, right? And he can never divorce her. Right? That's the ultimate punishment. He has to marry her, and he can never divorce her. Right? That's what the Torah says. Right now, it comes out, and remember, the Torah has ways of enforcing these things, right? Because if a guy has raped a young lady, right, and now the father of the girl insists that the guy should marry his daughter, the court says you're going to marry her. He says, I don't think so. Right? They pull out the stick or the whip, right, and they convince him that he's got to marry her, right? And then he sets up the next chuppah, invites rabbis, gives invitations, and he marries her, right?
If she says no,
she doesn't have to. He pays the fine.
And then he just walks
away. He pays the fine. Remember, we don't allow guys to run around raping people, right? Just because, well, she said no, right? Because obviously, because the question is always, well, what young lady would want to marry somebody?
Yes, right.
Would say yes, except that you're not thinking of it. You're thinking of it in terms of my contemporary society. In Torah society, a young lady who's been raped, remember, a young lady who's been raped is not a young lady who's been on college campus.
No,
a young lady who's been raped is tainted goods, and she may have a very strong, it's very likely that no one's going to want to marry her. Now, it's either marry this guy, who has, he's really a good guy, very concerned, just has a certain character flaw, right, rapes people, right, or maybe marry something, you know, learn to love them, right, or look, nobody condones rape, right? It's a tragedy, right? On the other hand, what are she now got to choose the best of two evils, right? It's either to remain by herself or to even marry this guy, right? So the Torah says he has to marry her, but if she's a married woman, then the act is by definition an act of capital offense. Therefore, you have a right to kill him if he is going to rape somebody against her will. If they are consenting sinners, then it's no different than somebody who himself is going to worship an idol with his own consent, right? Because that means he is doing a capital offense with his own consent. Therefore, the Torah says, there you're not allowed to go.
Capital
now.
Capital means public. Yes,
capital offense means death.
God,
death by court.
Is, but what I'm saying,
not public.
Is,
nothing to do with public or private. Nothing to do with public or private.
So you mean, this guy can be doing it privately, you're allowed to kill him.
No, you're not. That's what I'm saying. You're not allowed to kill her. You are not allowed to kill somebody who's going to do an avera, even if the court would execute him. As a private citizen, you may not kill her. The only time you may kill him for doing a crime is when, the rule is, when there is a human victim. When there is a human victim, and it is a sin which is deserving of capital offense, then you are allowed to take the law into your own hands. When there's a human victim, the example is somebody, he's going to rape a male, he's going to rape a married woman, or he's going to kill somebody, either you or somebody else, right? That he's going to kill somebody, right? That person or somebody else, then you have the right and the obligation to take the law in your own hands and to kill him, right? If somebody, and here's where the way with that, just to realize how severe the law is, if you see somebody is going to worship idols, and you just said, and you say to them, you know, Bernie, I'm doing this for your own good, right? And you blow them away, right? The halacha is, even though you had the best intentions in the world, you are tried 100% as a murderer in court, right? Even though he was worshiping idols, even though he was committing adultery, even though he was doing any of these terrible averas, you are tried 100% as a murderer in Beis Din. Josh?
So let's say you see a guy raping a girl and you kill him, and not knowing that the girl wasn't married. Like, how do you know right away?
Okay, so you have to try to do your best. Yeah, you have to try to do your best, right? You know, if there's any doubt whatsoever, then when you stand trial, you have to convince the court that you didn't know, you thought she was married, right? But if you happen to know she's not, you're just upset because, you know.
Well, let's say you don't know at all. She has a great wisdom. What do you do?
You have to make a judgment. You have to make a judgment the best you can.
My age, you got to start making the issue then.
Are you married, young lady?
No, you have to make it. I mean, what if you don't know? You see somebody's chasing somebody, you don't know if he intends to kill him. What are you going to do? The guy's chasing somebody down the street, you don't know if he intends to kill him or not. Maybe the guy he's chasing, maybe he's chasing a guy who himself is going to kill somebody. It's always just a judgment call. You got to make a reaction, and then in court you have to prove, I didn't know.